Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A proposal promising to help mental health and substance abuse services to the most severely impaired Californians is making its way through the state legislature and soon faces a key vote. The Community Assistance Recovery and Empowerment Court, or more commonly known as CARE Court, was announced earlier this year by Governor Newsom as a new solution to the homelessness crisis through court-mandated treatment and intervention to help those unhoused get off the streets and stay away from jail. The governor pitched this as the state needing to take more responsibility to change the status quo to reduce the growing number of people who are living and dying on the streets.
I mean, we could hold hands, have a candlelight vigil, talk about the way the world should be, or we could take some damn responsibility to implement our ideals. And that's what we're doing differently here.
But civil rights groups in California and across the country are pushing back. And California's county governments, who would be responsible for implementing this plan, are also raising red flags. Joining us to tell us where CARE Court currently stands and share their reporting on the potential impacts of this plan is CAP Radio reporters Nicole Nixon and Chris Nichols. Good morning, Nicole and Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Nicole, I want to start with you. Can you just remind us how CARE Court would be, or this proposal, would be different from the current system of conservatorships?
Yeah, well, the governor unveiled this proposal earlier this spring, and it's supposed to address people on the streets who are suffering not only from homelessness, but a severe mental illness. And, you know, he pointed out that the problem here is many times these people will cycle through hospitals, jails, end up back on the streets, and it's just this circle that never ends. Right now, in some cases, judges can order a conservatorship, which appoints a legal guardian for somebody that they believe cannot take care of themselves or make decisions for themselves. And CARE Court is pitched as sort of this in-between. It would be civil court-ordered treatment. And first responders and family members or loved ones of people with mental illnesses could petition the court for that treatment. Mm.
So it's currently making its way through the legislature. Where does it currently stand?
So it's awaiting a vote in the state assembly. It has to pass the assembly, and I think, you know, it's been changed a bit. So even if it does pass the assembly, it's got to go back to the Senate for what's called a concurrence vote. And then it would go to Governor Newsom. It's done pretty well in the legislature so far. It's gotten, you know, overwhelming yes votes. A few lawmakers have acknowledged some of the concerns and criticisms of this proposal, but the response has been mostly supportive. And then, of course, this legislative deadline is coming up next week. So we're expecting a vote on it, you know, anytime.
Yeah, it is fast approaching. So can you unpack more about why the governor says that the state needs to create a new intervention system as opposed to reforming the existing conservatorship system?
Well, he's been arguing that it's a broken system. It only serves a few thousand people at a time. According to the Department of Health Care Services, there were about 3,600 people on permanent conservatorships in California in 2020 and about 1,500 on temporary conservatorships. And then, you know, Newsom and his advisors say that conservatorships should be a last resort. And they believe that CARE Court can be more of an intervention to get people treatment before it gets to the point that they need a conservatorship or it gets to the point that they end up in jail or in the hospital. Here's Jason Elliott. He's a senior advisor to the governor on this issue.
I think to suggest that somehow we should wait until trauma to provide treatment is the wrong approach. And the status quo in California is that we wait until people end up in state hospital or prison. And we can bemoan that as a reality, but it is the reality right now.
Okay, so CARE Court is promising to get ahead of this and preventing people before they are placed in hospital or put in jail. But what do civil and disability rights advocates have to say about this proposal?
They are very, very wary of this proposal. The ACLU and disability rights organizations from across the country wrote a letter to Newsom urging him to pause it. They have equated it to involuntary treatment, and they point to evidence that compulsory treatment is less effective and has worse outcomes for people with addiction and mental disabilities. I talked to Eric Harris with Disability Rights California about this. He says that involuntary treatment can lead to more frustration, more trauma for people with mental disabilities. And after a bad experience, people are less likely to want to ever do it again.
that happens way more often the vast majority of time than somebody saying, oh, I didn't know before, but now that I've been forced to do this, I want to go about it again. That's not how this typically ends up working.
And Harris says, you know, this could actually have the opposite effect than its intended purpose, especially for people with marginalized backgrounds who are at a higher risk for homelessness and have this sort of compounding trauma from a bad experience.
Given the fact that the letter from disability rights advocates goes beyond California, it's from over 27 states, what was the governor's response?
Well, Newsom has not personally responded to that letter, as far as I know. But his advisor, Jason Elliott, who we heard from, you know, disputes that this would be involuntary treatment. Even though it may be ordered by a judge, he insists there will be no locked doors in care court and that treatment would not take place, you know, in a custodial setting like a jail or under a conservatorship. But again, their argument is that the status quo cannot continue because it just has not been working and the homelessness problem in California continues to get worse.
You know, a big crux of this is having enough housing and having enough beds. And there are housing advocacy groups in California. What do they have to say about this proposal?
Well, one of the main arguments against this proposal is that it's starting in the wrong place. And, you know, it's not focusing on the root of California's homelessness problem, which is there is not enough affordable housing. So housing advocates and others argue that, you know, that should be the starting point. If you put people in housing, they can stabilize and it's much easier for them to take care of their own mental health and other problems they may be facing. Here is Mari Castaldi with the advocacy group Housing California.
What decades of evidence show is that voluntary access to treatment and using housing as sort of the first step as a place for folks to get connected to treatment is really what works, not only at ending folks' homelessness, but in actually, you know, giving better mental health outcomes.
Okay, Nicole, so who supports this proposal?
A lot of local officials support it, especially at the city level. There are mayors from about 45 cities, you know, including Oakland, San Diego, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg have come out in support. And business groups are also in support. There is a bit of a division with local governments, though, which I know Chris will get into. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So earlier this week, the governor vetoed SB 57. That's a bill that would have allowed the first pilot programs for supervised drug injection sites in California, would connect them as well to services. Some who supported the bill suggested his decision to veto the bill had more to do with politics rather than health and public safety. What are you hearing from those who support or oppose Newsom in terms of the politics surrounding care court?
Well, I think if Newsom had signed the safe consumption bill, the attack ads from around the country would have written themselves. Homelessness is such a visible and such a widespread problem in California. And I think that, you know, no matter his presidential ambitions, this is something that he has got to tackle. And it's a stubborn problem. And I think either way, he sees this as, you know, one of his best options. And he's going to go for it either way.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking with CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about California's care court proposal. We're now going to bring in CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols to share what he learned about care court and how it will impact local governments. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicki.
Okay, so California's county governments would play a really large role in carrying out this initiative. How would counties specifically be involved?
They would play a really large role. Counties would be involved at just about every level of care court. You would have county public defenders represent the people who are selected as potential participants in this program, plus additional court staff. You would have clinical social workers, counselors, and therapists. They would all work with the participants. They're all county employees or contractors. They would help assess who is right for care court and who is not. They would spend time at court hearings, fill out reports and evaluations, and then eventually provide the mental health or addiction treatment ordered by the judge. I spoke with Ryan Quist about all of this. He's the director of Sacramento County's Department of Behavioral Health Services. And he said he has some real concerns about care court taking his limited number of clinical workers away from treatment and adding a large additional workload of what he described as more administrative duties.
In our world, these are administrative responsibilities that take my clinical staff away from their actual clinical work of providing services and supporting people and helping them on their path to recovery. What that means is that we see it everywhere. We hear everybody talking about it. We already have a workforce crisis where we don't have enough clinicians to be delivering the mental health, substance use disorder services that are needed out in our community. We have vacancies all over the place that we're currently not able to fill.
And Quist went on to say that his department already has a deficit of more than 100 clinical workers. And to give our listeners an idea of the workload of this department, Sacramento County provides mental health services for approximately 30,000 people per year and addiction services for about 4,000 or 5,000 people annually. That's all according to Quist. And the county is required to provide these services for Medi-Cal beneficiaries. And of course, this is all before Care Court is potentially added as a new responsibility.
Okay, so talking about a deficit of more than 100 clinical workers with potentially an added responsibility, we get into an issue or a challenge when it comes to the infrastructure to really scale up Care Court within county governments. How has the Newsom administration responded to these concerns?
Well, through negotiations with the counties, the Newsom administration has agreed not to have Care Court start right away in all locations. Jason Elliott from the governor's office, who we heard from earlier, he told us there will be a ramp up period and some counties will start later than others. And on that workforce shortage issue, Elliott says the Newsom administration has already approved funding to help with that.
The answer to it is a $1.7 billion workforce initiative to develop more than 20,000 new clinical social workers and other professionals in adjacent space, because we can do everything else right. And if we don't have people to do the jobs, then none of it matters.
And to learn more about that workforce initiative, I spoke with the California State Association of Counties, which represents county governments at the Capitol. And they told me they are hopeful that money translates into new trained workers, but they also cautioned that it can take a long time for that money to get sent out and for hirings to take place.
Well, Chris, on top of concerns over funding and staffing, another piece is housing. And county governments will be responsible for finding housing for people who take part in Care Court. What did they say about this prospect?
Right. As we talked about a little bit earlier, housing is a big part of this. And under the Care Court plan, a judge could order counties to provide housing for participants. Counties are very concerned about this. Ryan Quist, again with Sacramento County, pointed out what we all know. There's really a severe lack of available housing across the state right now.
If part of the focus is to try to address homelessness, we really need to focus on that housing availability, because we can get individuals into services, help them get better, but then once they're better, where are they going to live? And so really, we need to focus on making sure that we have sufficient housing for this population.
And now the governor's office points to nearly $15 billion already approved in recent years for homeless housing. That has led to the opening of several thousand new units for unhoused residents, largely in the form of converted motel rooms. And there are more that are opening up in future months.
So given that there still is a good amount to hash out, Chris, what are you going to be looking for if Care Court passes the legislature and Newsom signs it into law?
Well, I think locally we'll be watching to see how early things ramp up in Sacramento County, how early they're required to start up. And of course, we'll be watching those workforce issues. Is the county able to quickly hire the number of clinical social workers and counselors and therapists that are needed to not only provide this treatment, but go through this court process with anyone who is selected for Care Court? And then, of course, we'll be watching the housing issue. As you know, part of my job covering affordable housing and homelessness, we'll see how quickly homeless housing actually gets online in our region.
All right, Nicole, you reminded us, I mean, there's a very quick deadline. You know, we got about a week at the state capitol. So if the legislature passes this and Newsom signs it into law, where does your reporting take you?
I mean, I think, like Chris mentioned, the staffing issue will be huge, partly because there's a shortage, but now we're going to have all these counties competing for workers. I think that will be really interesting to watch. And then, you know, I would love to be keeping in touch with these disability rights groups about who's actually being pulled in for this program. They are really concerned about, you know, people of different or marginalized backgrounds, LGBTQ people who have historically been, you know, part of institutionalization. And they're very, very concerned about that.
CAP Radio reporters Nicole Nixon and Chris Nichols, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki.
Up next, we're going to hit the road with United Farm Workers as they close in on a 335-mile march to the state capitol and listen to what they're fighting for. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The United Farm Workers are making their way to the steps of the state capitol to demand Governor Newsom sign Assembly Bill 2183 after vetoing the voting choice bill last year. UFW says it would allow farm workers to vote free of intimidation, in secret, or wherever they feel safe. Leading the 335-mile march that began in Delano, which is in Kern County, just north of Bakersfield, is current United Farm Workers President Teresa Romero. Our very own Insight assistant producer, Victor Corral Martinez, joined her on the pilgrimage earlier this week while they were in Galt, marching through Hope Road and the farming back roads of Sacramento County, and discussed why the march was necessary.
We started our march in Delano 21 days ago. We have walked a little over 300 miles. We want the governor to sign the bill, the AB 2183. That would make it easier for farm workers to join a union, to vote for union representation. Right now, the only way they can do it is in person, which is intimidating and doesn't promote participation. So we want them to have options to do it by mail, to do it in person if they still want to ask somebody to mail it back for them or to deliver it. So it mirrors the way that we vote in California for elected officials.
How did we get to this point where I thought we had decades that we've fought for farmer rights and we're still doing it today?
And that is very sad, that in order to get benefits for farm workers, we have to fight for decades. We should not be marching today to get something that farm workers deserve. To me, enough is enough. People need to appreciate the work that they do, the importance of the work that they do, and they are the ones that through the pandemic, through fires, through pesticides, through temperatures of 100 degrees or 110, 115, continue to work in the fields. They put food on our tables and we should treat them better.
Why do you feel that we don't have these human rights already established?
You know, farm workers were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act. And for some reason, and I know what it is, it was a racist reason back then, especially in the South. Most farm workers were black. And now, because once they're excluded, it takes a long time, a lot of effort, a lot of years, a lot of money to be able to gain these rights for farm workers, and we have to do it state by state.
And what made you guys want to just march instead of doing it a different method?
Well, we introduced the bill last year. The governor vetoed it. We needed to really show not only the governor, but our community that this is important for farm workers, to the point that they're sacrificing their bodies, their work, their income, and walking almost 340 miles to ask the governor to sign the bill.
And what would you say to people that maybe they don't really care, that that doesn't affect them?
It affects all of us throughout the country. Without this workforce, they don't have food on their tables. That is as simple as that. And if they are working so hard under such difficult conditions to put food on all of our tables, the entire country, it should be something that we all should be interested in. It's something that affects every single one of us.
And how is the outreach, or is there any support from the community or community leaders?
The community and the community leaders and some legislators in Sacramento have been amazing. They're supporting us, they're feeding us, they're housing us. They are making sure that as we walk, we have water, we have something, sometimes fruit. They stop at the side of the road to give us whatever they can. And that really tells you that the community cares. People care. We just want to make sure that these workers choose whether or not they want union representation without the intimidation, without the threats, without their cases where immigration has been called when they're voting. So enough is enough.
And, you know, we're on New Hope Road. Do you feel there is strong hope that the governor will sign the bill?
You know, we have learned through years, we of course are hopeful. We continue to communicate with them. We are willing to find compromise and middle ground, but we're not willing to sacrifice farm workers. So we'll find out when we get there to see if he's gonna give us an answer of what he's gonna do in our bill. But the important thing is we're not gonna give up.
And how are you hanging out? I mean, this is a lot of walking. It would be a lot for a young person, an athletic person.
It is hard. You know, our bodies hurt. Our feet have blisters. But when we get to communities, when we see people supporting us, it just gives you the energy that you need. It's tiring. It's a toll on your body. But we're not, like I said, we're here to stay. We're not going anywhere.
How are your feet?
Tired, blistered.
So since you're the president of the UFW right now, you know, everyone's looking to you to lead. How does that feel to really have to, you know, whether you're tired or not, to be in front and lead the way?
You know, I don't feel the pressure. I'm excited, I'm motivated. I am happy to be here with these people that work so hard and then are marching and sacrificing so much. It is a privilege, it's an honor for me to be here with them.
And so I've seen very diverse group of people come to show support, bring water. And a lot of times we make it like a, especially farm workers, like La Raza thing, but there's a lot of different people. What does it mean to just have people of all colors and races and genders and identities come to support?
You know, it is very good. We had just Martin Luther King III march with us a couple of days ago, because this is not the struggle of one, it's all of our struggles. And people who are here really understand not only how hard they work, but how important their work is. And when farm workers are harvesting our food, they don't say this is going to go to a specific race. They're not saying I'm harvesting for Democrats or Republicans. They're harvesting food for all of us. So that means that we all get the benefit of their hard work.
So let's say the governor signs the bill. What's the next step? What's the next move?
We make sure that the bill's implemented, that we can then communicate with them, with farm workers, letting know about the bill, let them know what it would do, what the options are, what their choices are. And this bill is going to give them a choice, free and safe way of voting yes or no for a union. But it's entirely up to them without the intimidation.
There's a pretty good, strong caravan here. Does it make you proud that there's so many people here that are with you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These people are here also sacrificing some of their time with their family at work, taking vacation. I've talked to people who this, when they found out, they saw it on social media, they came, say, you know, I'm taking a week vacation because I want to be with you guys. That is dedication. That is support. That is the power that, you know, the movement has in attracting people who care about farm workers.
For those that will eventually hear this, what do you want them to learn from this march?
What I want them to learn it is that we all have rights, but in order for us to get better rights for farm workers, we have to work 3 times as hard, probably 5 times as long. And I want them to understand that it shouldn't be. They're human beings that are here. They have a family, they like all of us. And sometimes, you know, we have farm workers that work seasonally. So they have to follow crop to crop. They move their kids. The sacrifices that they make are incredible.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we just listened to Insight's assistant producer, Victor Corral Martinez, interview United Farm Workers President Teresa Romero about UFW's 335-mile march to the state capitol. We're now going to bring in Adam Eckelman from the Modesto Bee and Dr. Edward Flores from the UC Merced Community and Labor Center. Thanks for joining us, Adam and Edward.
Thanks for having me, Vicki.
Thank you for having us.
So we just heard from Teresa Romero, the president of UFW, briefly talk about what the bill's goal is. Adam, starting with you, can you just unpack further what Assembly Bill 2183 will do and who are the key players pushing it through the legislature?
Mm-hmm. So 2183, this is an assembly bill. It is right now under review at the Senate. It is predicted to pass the Senate and will ultimately make it once again to Governor Newsom's desk, where he will have the decision to sign it. Now, as UFW President Teresa Romero just said with Victor, he vetoed this last year. So we're not really sure what's going to happen. Now, what the bill really calls for, you can kind of think about it akin to a general election. You know, with the pandemic for the past few years, the nation in many different states, like California, has moved to mail-in voting as being, you know, really a general election right. And so in short, you know, what the UFW is asking is that when farm workers vote and have the decision to vote for a union, that they have the right to do that from home. Typically, this happens at, you know, a secret ballot, often sometimes at the workplace. And the fear is that some farm workers feel intimidated and that they would be a little bit better off if they could vote from home. Now, that said, you know, there's some opposition from the agricultural industry where they say that this bill would lead to intimidation by unions, and that they say that this is not really akin to, you know, a general election mail-in voting process, because there are some key changes. There's some ways in which unions might have the upper hand here. For instance, this bill would allow for unions to collect ballots at any point in one calendar in a 12-month cycle. So they could give out the ballots in January and they could actually file to the Labor Relations Board in December of that year. So they can kind of spend a whole year gathering ballots. They also point out that, you know, the union could fill out the ballot on behalf of somebody, and as long as they get that individual signature, they can submit that as a valid ballot. Now, I should point out that's actually the same as our general election. But in general, what you're seeing is this bill would enable union elections for farm workers to kind of mirror the mail-in process we have, but with a couple of key differences.
Why did the governor veto the bill last year? What was his reasoning?
Well, he didn't exactly specify in vivid detail, but what he did say is that there were, and I'm quoting here, various inconsistencies and procedural issues related to the collection and the review of ballot cards. Now, we're all wondering, what exactly did he mean there?
But it's pretty wordy.
Yeah, it's a little wordy. I think he's probably talking to what I said here, where there are some ways in which this is not exactly like, you know, the way you would vote in a primary or in a general election here in California. This, you know, you can give a ballot in January and then the union can collect it in December. The agricultural and kind of business arm here, like the Farm Bureau, they've also pointed out that you don't have to distribute ballots to everyone. So it's not like every employee necessarily would get a mail-in ballot. The union can decide to give ballots to those who they think are more sympathetic. So there are some ways here in which it's a little bit different. So that might be one of the challenges, but really, we don't exactly know why Newsom vetoed it, and we're not sure what he's going to do this time.
Edward, I want to bring you in, and I want to hone in on something that Teresa Romero touched on briefly, and it was about the National Labor Relations Act. And she said that its exclusion of farm workers is racially motivated. What did she mean by that?
Thank you for that question. What she meant was that farm workers and domestic workers are the only workers that are excluded from the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. This was a bill that was negotiated with racist Southern legislators that sought to exclude Black people from having the same rights as whites. And so to this day, farm workers do not have the same protections as all other workers under the National Labor Relations Act.
You're based in the Central Valley, UC Merced, and you had the community and labor center. Have you heard if farm workers really want to unionize?
So we work with organizations, community, labor, faith, environmental groups. And the concern, generally speaking, is with the rights of all workers. The UFW was built upon a religious, social, racial, and economic justice tradition of being concerned with those furthest on the margins. In this case, as you're pointing out, agricultural workers that were deliberately excluded from having the same rights as all workers. And so an action like the one that we're seeing today falls into this broader tradition. And this is really about the rights of all farm workers. It's more than just about unions, because every farm worker should have the right to cast a vote free of intimidation and retaliation.
Adam, what have you heard from farm workers when it comes to the desire to unionize?
You know, I've definitely heard from folks who say that when they have that, you know, regular ballot at their employer's, you know, workplace, that they feel intimidated. And many of the folks that I've spoken to, some of them, you know, while I was walking and talking to folks in Turlock and Modesto last week, they shared that, you know, many of them are undocumented. I spoke with a number of folks who are undocumented. One of the representatives from the United Farm Workers told me that, you know, a pretty high percentage, somewhere between 50 and 70% of farm workers are undocumented. So they say this is a particularly vulnerable population who is not, you know, who needs special protections and special rights. And I will say, you know, mail-in voting is something that we're starting to see as a broader right here, but union elections and general elections are, they are pretty different. And I think it's important to note that difference.
I'm curious for the both of you. Edward, I'll start with you. If the bill is vetoed again, what is the next step for farm worker rights? And if it were to pass, what kind of effects would it have on other states in terms of agricultural farm workers?
So we've been seeing just generally that workers' rights have been attacked by courts, by legislatures for the past few decades. And so we've seen that unions have been in decline for decades for that reason. What the labor movement and its allies need right now are innovative strategies for building unions and building worker power. So the march that we see today is an example of that. Some of the recent campaigns that the UFW has been involved with that have been successful have been about advocating for a heat standard, making overtime pay the law, extending paid sick leave during the pandemic. These are all issues that extend beyond union workers. And so what we're seeing more and more of today is a concerted effort on behalf of unions to raise standards for all workers and to extend the labor movement beyond just unions. And so I think regardless of the outcome, we're going to continue to see that.
Mm. Adam, you walked with them in Modesto and Turlock. I mean, did they ever talk about, you know, if the bill is vetoed again, because it was vetoed last year, what their next steps are?
No, there's certainly this sentiment, and I think it dates back to really the history of the United Farm Workers, this si se puede attitude. You know, we're going to keep trying, we're going to do this again. And also to build on what Edward said, you know, when Cesar Chavez led a march from Delano to Sacramento in 1966, you know, there was a lot of momentum. And in the early years of the United Farm Workers, they tallied, you know, somewhere around 70,000 members. This was a small but mighty union that was organizing a population that had otherwise, you know, been considered impossible to organize. Today, those numbers are pretty small. You know, they estimate that there's somewhere around 7,000 members in the United Farm Workers. And so there's been a lot of setbacks. There was a Supreme Court decision last year that really modified the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. And, you know, in general, unions have seen these setbacks. But at the same time, there's been some gains. I mean, we've seen Amazon unionize. We've seen Starbucks start to unionize. So I think that there's a possibility here that UFW is trying to ride this wave, you know, in favor of workers, and that this march, regardless of whether or not the governor vetoes it, could help fuel some support for the United Farm Workers and perhaps bring them back to the heyday of, you know, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, when they were really building momentum throughout the valley.
Adam and Edward, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is Modesto B Equity reporter Adam Eckelman and Dr. Edward Flores, faculty director of the UC Merced Community and Labor Center, discussing the United Farm Workers 335-mile march from Kern County, which will be culminating at the state capitol later this week. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Our final guest today shares my passion for deeper conversations with notable Californians to better understand our history, culture, environment, and politics. Stu Van Aersdale is a journalist, lecturer at Sac State, and the host of What is California? Podcast. Van Aersdale, whose previous work has been featured in the New York Times, Slate, Esquire, and Vanity Fair, launched the first episode of his podcast last September with the goal of better understanding the Golden State through conversations with noteworthy residents. Since then, he's produced two seasons, and a third is set to be released in September. So joining us now is Stu Van Aersdale. Welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Okay, so you're a Sacramento native. You're a Sac State graduate as well. You're a journalist. You taught journalism, teach journalism at Sac State. So just tell us more about what inspired you to start podcasting and why focus specifically on California in the way that you do.
When I started this podcast, it was kind of the culmination of years of looking for a show about California that wasn't just news and current affairs, which are great. There are great shows about those topics, and you know, CAP Radio has several of them. And I thought, what can we do that actually will get a little bit more philosophical about California? What can we do that will showcase those notable Californians you mentioned a minute ago, and really spotlight conversations about what the Golden State means? And I just had some time on my hands, and I just kind of just threw a Hail Mary to some special guests, and the rest is history.
Yeah, you're about to kick off your third season, but looking back at the previous two, who have been some of your favorite guests so far?
My favorite guest so far, unquestionably, was the first guest, Jerry Brown. He was wonderful. You know, he definitely was challenging and engaging, but not unwilling to tangle with topics that he's talked about over the years. And I feel we got a little bit deeper into his career and his life and his work. So that was a lot of fun. But we don't just talk to political figures. We also talk to some kind of unexpected, unorthodox figures like the Jimmy Kimmel Live writer, Louis Vertel.
I listened to that one.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's amazing. And he had one of my favorite conclusions to the episode. We ask every guest, who's your favorite Californian? I won't spoil it. You can go listen to it if you haven't. But he had a great answer to that question. We also talked to Stacy Corliss, who is a Mono County supervisor and who enlightened us a little bit about the challenges and the opportunities faced in rural California, which I thought was really cool.
I'm going to play a clip from season one. You spoke with former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs about how California and its people influenced him. So here's a little part of that conversation.
How have California's people and culture impacted or influenced who you are?
Oh, man. So California, I think, has really influenced my worldview, my outlook, my sense of optimism, my sense of what's possible. I think sort of just the diversity, being growing up in Stockton, the most diverse city, and listening to Suavemente one song and then hyphy music the next song at every party, and that just being part of growing up. Eating everyone's food, having the Sikh temple around the corner from the house. Like all those experiences, my neighbors being refugees from Guam. And then my other neighbors being from Pakistan. Then across the street, some white folks. And two houses down, some Latino folks. Like, it was just diversity and just being very comfortable with difference and diversity, I think, comes a direct result of being in California. But I think also just idea of sort of innovation, of thinking new, of being bold, of not having possibilities. I think that's part of the Disneyland, Silicon Valley, Stanford, California ethos. I think that's something that has really influenced me, just a sense that we can lead, we should lead, we can create the future.
Yeah, I think what Michael Tubbs is saying, it really resonates with a lot of people who are native Californians, that diversity. Is that a common thread that you get when talking to your guests who are notable Californians?
Absolutely, because I always ask them, what is one thing that folks outside the state might misunderstand about California, and how can we set those folks straight? And the thing they always come back to is that, you know, this is the most diverse state it's the fifth largest economy, right? So it's its own country in a way, you know, so its own diverse kind of ecosystem. And folks tend to think of California outside the state sometimes as, you know, all surfers and glam or all Silicon Valley or whatever. But when we think about the diversity, the economic diversity, the social diversity, the cultural diversity, the corporate diversity, the intellectual diversity, that itself, I think, attests to the need to have a show like this to kind of break all those pieces down and figure out what exactly works, how they work together, what doesn't work, and how we can improve it.
I want to bring up an interview you did. We've actually had her as a guest on Insight when she retired, and this is Elaine Howe, who is the former state auditor. And you asked her a really interesting question about the public perception of her and her work. So let's listen to a part of that.
One of the most common characterizations we hear of your work is scathing.
Yeah, I know.
Right? Like, yeah. In a scathing audit,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Elaine Howell writes or reports, et cetera, right. Et cetera.
Right.
I actually Googled the phrase scathing audit and Elaine Howell together and came up with almost 900 responses.
Wow.
So I'm curious, how do you feel about that characterization?
I don't particularly like that characterization. I think there are some audits where we are pretty direct and we've identified some serious issues. But I think that term gets used too frequently. Obviously, if you've had 900 some odd hits on my name and scathing, I mean, what our audits are intended to do is, as I've said to staff and I've spoken at legislative hearings, it's speak the truth to power. to let people know we've audited this program. We've looked at how the agency, the state agency, is implementing the program, and we found some significant weaknesses and it needs to be improved.
Yeah, when I interviewed her in December, she retired. I told her as a journalist, like whenever I saw her audits, I would just totally like just geek out and open up the email because they could be pretty damning, and rightfully so. That's her job.
Absolutely. And this show, What is California, is about that kind of bigger philosophical picture, to be sure. But when folks like Elaine Howell come along, a one-of-a-kind Californian, that's where we do kind of like veer into the kind of public affairs sphere. And I want to know more about, how California Alley actually operates. Who is holding power to account in California? Who is holding our elected leaders accountable and our institutions accountable? And Elaine Howell was someone whom, when I heard she was retiring, I said, I've got to get her on the show. And miracle of miracles, we did.
Good. I'm glad you did. Well, let's move to season three, a little bit of a preview. One of the guests you mentioned is Alicia Garza, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement. Give us a preview of some of the themes and the topics that you discussed with her.
Well, one of the things that compelled me about Alicia was obviously her role as a Black activist or activist for Black issues in the last 10 to 15 years, but particularly how California has influenced these movements. We don't really think about the roots of these movements. We think about the triggers of the movements. We think about the kind of milestones in the movements, but we don't necessarily think about their origins and how our surroundings influence those movements. And that's what I wanted to ask Alicia about.
We're going to listen to a clip, and she is responding or following up to a question that you asked, to a statement that she made earlier in your interview about the perception of Black people in California.
You said a minute ago that Black folks in the Bay Area get a bad rap.
Oh, totally.
Why is that?
Well, California is not seen as one of those places that has a high density of Black people, and therefore it's not seen as a place where Black culture is innovated, but it should be. I think, more of the East Coast and Southern places get a lot more of that credit. And I saw a meme on social media the other day that was talking about how weird Black people are from California. And I was like, it depends on your perspective. I think we wouldn't see weird as pejorative, right? But also, California actually, I can't tell you which number, but we are one of the top 10 most densely populated states with Black people in it. But we don't often get that credit. I also know that California, and then the Bay Area in particular, has really been a hotbed for Black freedom organizing, from the Black Panther Party for self-defense, to there's many different kind of trends and movements that have started in the Bay Area that have positively impacted the lives of Black people all over the country.
So, Stu, as a native Californian and as a seasoned journalist, what have you learned from this podcast?
Well, the number one thing I've learned about this podcast is that, we are this state that is challenged in so many ways. But there are so many different ideas for how to resolve these challenges. One of the things I do in this show is I ask all the guests really the same batch of questions. We do talk about their work a little bit to make it specific, but I always ask about what their earliest memories of the state are. I ask about folks and places who've influenced or inspired them over the years. But one question I ask is, what's the biggest challenge California faces and how can we surmount it? And everyone has such unique, interesting answers, and it inspires me and compels me to think, okay, we can maybe solve these problems, because sometimes they feel insoluble. You look at fires, you look at drought, you look at housing, et cetera, and it's just a lot. But when you talk to these folks and you think solutions-minded and you hear their perspectives, it reassures me that maybe we can get through this together.
Maybe we'll be okay. What do you hope listeners take away from this podcast?
Hopefully the same conclusions about the challenges we face, but if nothing else, I want them to come away with a unique perspective on these figures, a lot of whom we know. We don't always have, celebrities or elected officials or big names on there. We have some more kind of folks you may not have heard of, but the whole point is, do they have interesting stories? And are their perspectives on this state relatable? And in many cases, you find that we all have so much in common.
you know, and that's the story that I think I've discovered over two seasons. And so far, putting season three together, that's the story I think we're going to continue to tell.
Do you have a dream guest that you haven't yet locked down?
Yeah, actually, I've got a few. If Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is listening, I want to get him on the show. Jessica Milan Patterson, the chairwoman of the California Republican Party, I think she'd be great. We've been talking about getting her on the show, trying to work on that. So fingers crossed that'll happen. Dolores Huerta, obviously, the labor leader. She's in her 90s. She's still kicking. We'd love to get her on the show. John Miller, the Giants broadcaster. That'd be great.
It goes on and on. Yeah, I was so lucky to interview Dolores Huerta for her birthday this year. Mm. Finally, just about 15, 20 seconds. Who is your favorite Californian?
Oh, Joan Didion, unquestionably. Yeah. The writer Joan Didion, she's given me such material to chew on, such ideas to think about for years and years to come.
Yeah, I reread the White Album after she passed away, and also a Sacramentan well. Stu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky.
Stu Van Aerstale is the host of the podcast What is California? A quest to better understand our state through conversations with some of its most notable Californians. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. A happy, happy, happy birthday to Chris Feltz, and have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.